So we're here for ECE 581, High Frequency Power Electronics. I am Professor Daniel Costanet. The plan for today is we'll go over a little bit of just course details, syllabus type stuff, and then I'm going to jump into a motivating example of a converter design. And that will likely carry us through Monday, maybe some of Wednesday's lecture. That example, I'm going to kind of show some different design approaches and how they impact the converter to start to talk about the concepts that we're going to be focusing on in this course. So let's dive in. So this course called High Frequency Power Electronics focuses on the design and modeling of that type of converter. You notice here I put high frequency in quotes because this is something I put in the course title because it makes sense and people kind of know what they're getting when I put this in there, but it's actually a very bad name for the class, and I admit that. What does high frequency mean? Well, depending on the application, it could be completely different ranges. High frequency is 100 kilohertz here and 100 megahertz there, depends on what you're doing. Also, there is, and I'll talk about this more and throughout the course, there's no reason why you want to design a high-frequency converter. Okay? So right away, get out of your mind, high-frequency is never a good thing. Occasionally, high-frequency is a pathway to something you want to get. Okay? So we're never just going to high-frequency because high-frequency is good. We want to design a very small converter, and going to high-frequency might let me make the passive smaller to get there. Or I need a converter with excellent transient response, so I have to go to high switching frequency in order to get the control bandwidth I need. This is a pathway, but never a goal. Right? You never say, I have this converter, no reason to make it, but I'll just go to 100 megahertz for fun. Okay? It's always something's motivating you to do that. Okay? So the course website I emailed out, was everybody able to access that? I think that's been added to the departmental webpage now. I will coordinate a lot of the class for that webpage. So I expect that you'll be checking that regularly. It's where I'll post assignments. It's where I'll post my lecture slides. For those of you who have had a course with me, you know this. For those of you who hadn't had a course with me before, before class, I'll post the slides that I'm going to lecture from during class so that if you'd like, you can print those out and take notes on them. That's because we get later into the course, I might have a lot of schematics that I want to talk about, and it's hard to copy down and keep pace with me if I've got them on my slides already. Then after class, I'll upload this set of slides, which during the lecture, I'll go through and annotate, and I'll save those annotations and upload to them to the course website. I also wear a mic here and record my lectures, both the slides and the audio, and I'll post those to the website. The annotated slides, the recorded lecture, are there as supplemental materials for you. Occasionally, I'll have some glitch. I'll lose the annotated slides. I'll lose the recorded lecture, and I won't be able to post them. I expect that you'll still have, from attending class and taking your notes, all the information you need. So if there is some problem, the annotated slides, the recorded lectures, you shouldn't rely on those. Still come to class. You're still required to be here, to be taking notes, understanding. Okay? Those are just extra kind of materials if you want to go back and look at something. Okay, so the goal of the course is to understand the motivations. We've talked about before why you would go to high frequency, what are the problems you're going to run into, and how do you design around that. Okay. The prerequisites I expect that everybody's had, basic circuits, microelectronics, and an introductory course in power electronics covers things like average modeling, basic controls, basic converter design, CCM, DCM, small ripple approximation, these kinds of things. Okay, just my contact info here. For those of you who have been in a course before, I've changed offices. I'm now in MK504. My email, I'll do my best to respond to any emails within 24 hours. I don't guarantee 24-hour response on the weekends. I'll still try to do that. And then office hours, I've tentatively put Tuesdays 11 to 12 and Wednesdays 9 to 10. OK, Can everybody make at least one of those in your schedule? Anybody have any strong preferences on against these office hours or for? Is anybody really excited about these office hours? Wants the voice support? All right. So we'll stick with those for now. And then, of course, by appointment, I'm available. Email anytime. We can set up some time outside of that meet and talk as we progress in the course. As you email me, please use square brackets EC581 in the subject line. It just makes it easier for me to keep track of things. More likely that I can respond quickly when I see that. Okay, so we're going to meet Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 10:10 to 11 o'clock. It should have been zero. Roughly speaking, the university guidelines are you should spend about 3 hours outside of lecture for every 1 hour of lecture. This is 3 hours of lecture a week, so plan to spend on the order of 9 hours a week outside of class working on homework and eventually projects. The grading structure will have one homework per week starting next week. Generally, the assignments will be due on Fridays unless we discuss otherwise in here. All the assignment due dates will be posted on the schedule on the course website. I'm going to do something new that I haven't done, but I'm likely all you guys have seen is I'm going to use Canvas for you to turn in assignments this semester, just to manage that a little bit better than I've done in the past. So everything will be turned in through Canvas. I'm not going to use Canvas for anything else other than assignment turn-in and grade reporting. So everything else will be handled on the course website, but Canvas will handle assignment submission. And then in the same category, we're going to have a design competition. We'll talk about that later in class after we've covered sufficient material for you to be able to begin that design. But the idea there is to apply the material that we're discussing in class. And this is going to be somewhat open-ended. There will be a set of specifications. We will, in groups, decide how to tackle those, come up with a design approach, report on that. If it is well formulated, you'll go on to build and construct that, and then the team demonstrating the best performance will get some rather significant extra credit in the course. Okay. So this will result in actually testing, building and testing the converters themselves. Okay, and then for exams, we'll have a midterm and a final, roughly October 29th for the midterm, but we'll nail that down as we get to within about a week of the midterm. I'll give you some warning about that. Okay, assignments, like I said, will be submitted through Canvas. They'll be due before lecture starts on whatever date they're assigned, unless otherwise noted. So generally, that's going to be the Friday at 10:10. The assignments need to be submitted. No late work accepted, except in documented medical emergencies. And the way I approach homeworks is you are very much encouraged to work together on homework. Okay. Make sure, you know, if you turn in a carbon copy, that's going to be a problem. But if you sit and work through the whole assignment in teams or groups, that's fine. The homeworks are there for you to practice applying the material, to learn the quizzes, exams. At the moment, no plan for quizzes, so really mean midterm and final. There is absolutely no collaboration. That's where you're really assessed. In the vein of that, in that spirit, homeworks will be graded fairly leniently. So if you are applying the correct theory, you're trying to do the right kinds of things, you'll get the order of a B to an A on the homework. But it'll be marked wherever you went wrong. And what you need to be especially careful with is a B or a low A on the homework will not translate to a B or a low A on the exam. Okay? So exams are graded much harder. Exams are graded for correctness and completeness. Homeworks are graded as a learning experience. So I don't want to take off a lot of points if you're making mistakes here and there. More so, I want to mark those and have you use that as a learning opportunity. Look through the solutions that I post, go back, understand what you did wrong, make sure by exam time you know how to do it correctly. So just be sure, I've had people real surprised and say, oh, I got B's on all the homeworks, but then I failed the exam. Well, every one of those homeworks, you're making mistakes and you made the same ones on the exams. Those are graded much harder. So be wary of that. Homeworks are for learning, but it's expected that you are, after grading, going back, looking at solutions, learning what you did wrong. Okay. No required textbook for this course. There are small materials, mostly review and a little bit from chapters 19 and 20 that are relevant to what we're doing, from the Fundamentals of Power Electronics book by Erickson and Maksymovich. I recommend you buy this. I think it's a good reference manual to have for anybody who's here taking a graduate course in power electronics, but you don't need to. We won't have anything assigned directly from there, any readings from there that are required. It's also available online through the UT Libraries network. Throughout the course, may make use of MATLAB, Simulink, LTSpice. They're all available in the on-camp or the computer labs in the department as well. LTSpice is free to install. MATLAB has a reasonable student version. Like I said, all this stuff will be posted on the course website, as well as any additional information, additional materials, references, simulation files that I use in class. Okay, so questions before I move on any of the practical details of the course? Whatever you want. There's no required attendance of office hours. If you're doing fine, you don't need to come to them. Those are just times where I'm going to guarantee that I'll be available in the office. If you want to pop in, ask questions, you're welcome to. Okay. Does that answer your question? So we will coordinate that. How many people here have access to research equipment in your own GRA lab? Okay. Well, so we'll sort that all out as we start the competition. In the past, if everybody here has access to the baseline set of equipment needed, then I won't do anything. Okay, I'll let you guys do it from your research lab benches. We'll partner in groups of two as long as at least one person has that equipment. If anybody does not, I'll make sure that you have it available and have times when you can access that. Okay. Anything else?
Yeah. Will the exam be take home or in class?
In class until I say otherwise. But we'll decide when we get there. Anything else? Okay. Then we will move on. Like I said, we're going to get into a motivating example. First, I just want to talk generally why high frequency. Point that I'll emphasize throughout the course is this is really a means to an end. Looking at a couple of example applications here, LED driver, VRM, these things are of a size that is largely dictated by large passive components, right? Electrolytic caps here, like magnetic components, CMI filters, those dominate the size of it. If I want to shrink these things down, I really need to focus on how can I shrink down the size of the passive components for the right kind of components in the right situation. One way to reduce the size of them is to increase my switching frequency. They are designed based on a ripple specification at the switching frequency. Going higher switching frequency will allow me to keep that ripple with a smaller passive component. Another that I mentioned, control bandwidth. If I want to be able to regulate out to very high frequency, fundamentally in any switching converter, I have a limitation of the switching frequency for my control bandwidth. That's because every period, I can take one control action. I can switch once, a simple buck converter. Once I turn on the MOSFET, I'm done for that period. I can't do anything until the next switching period. Right? I get one duty cycle per switching period. Therefore, I can't regulate anything that's changing faster than the switching frequency. I can only do one thing per switching period. If something needs me to regulate within that, I have no mechanism to do that. My control bandwidth is going to be limited to less than and 481 type analysis, maybe a decade, significantly less than my switching frequency. Okay. I need to regulate at 1 megahertz for something like a VRM application where I'm powering a processor that's having very rapid load changes. I need to switch well above 1 megahertz. Another reason why I might go to high frequency. Okay. In order to get there, as I begin scaling up my low frequency converter to higher frequencies for one of these reasons or another motivating factor, I need to, in most cases, think about redesigning. I take the same converter and I go up in switching frequency. Generally, my switching losses are going to increase. In the base case that we won't talk about in this class, I could just let it get much worse and put a bigger heatsink, perhaps. That's probably not a good solution. Instead, we're going to look at how we can achieve good performance as I increase the switching frequency through things like switching devices, how I select them and how I use them, control of the converter. Really, when I say control, bumping in modulation. Not necessarily closed loop control, though we will talk about that, but how I actually design the switching sequence in the converter. And then alterations in the converter topologies and how I actually design the passives. Magnetic capacitors. Okay. Most of our focus will really be here in this course. We'll talk about modeling switching losses in devices, how we design modulation schemes to minimize those switching losses, different topologies that allow me to reduce switching losses and achieve high efficiency. We'll mention this briefly. But we won't have a full course on the design of high-frequency magnetics or selection of high-frequency capacitors. Okay. So, look at how this might play out. I'm going to use a motivating example. Here's just one slide to talk about what the converter I'm going to design might be used for. I'm just giving an example application. This is a called mild hybrid electric vehicle. It's looking at expanding the low voltage system on electric vehicles. Typically, we have this 12 volt system that has a lead acid battery on all of your cars for many decades. This low voltage system now is 12 volts. It has all of the computational requirements for modern intelligent vehicles on it. Consumes a lot of power. Okay. So might have been that this was a few hundred watts before, a few decades ago when there was nothing really on there but the starter. But now this powers all of your infotainment, powers all of the monitoring and actuation, all of the drive-by-wire type systems, powers many pumps, regulators throughout the car. So this 12-volt bus is getting in the 3-plus kilowatts load range today, which at 12 volts, by as many hundreds of amps, which is becoming a problem because that has to be conducted through cables. Cables are getting very thick, very costly in vehicles, whether it's an EV or just a gasoline vehicle, the system still exists. Okay. Many companies are looking at moving up to a 48-volt bus in addition to the 12-volt bus to allow more of that power to be distributed through a higher voltage with lower current. So some of the higher power loads we put on the 48-volt bus instead of the 12-volt bus, including the starter. You can drop that current down. So I mentioned this just as one example application, but what we're going to look at is the design of a DC to DC converter from 12 to 48 volts. Okay, and we're going to look at some of the design issues with that. This slide just to show, there's validity to this. We have applications where we may need a 12 to 48 volt converter. I'm going to design it at a little bit lower power than would probably be needed here, but maybe this is a distributed type conversion architecture. Okay, so I'm going to propose a set of specs for going from 12 volts in to 48 volts out. look at a 48 ohm load, give me 48 watts, 1 amp at the output, and I'm just going to specify ripple voltage at the output is 0.1 volts. And I could go through and design this thing. It would take me a long time. I'd have to think about topologies, devices, control modulation, passives. I didn't have the time to do that. So what I did is I went to TI and used their Webbench, gave them these specs, and they spit out a design for me. So, done. That is, you know, once you guys graduate and you go out and become design engineers, that's how you do it, right? They just give you specs, you plug them into a tool, you give them whatever spits out. That's what you get your PhD for. Yeah.
Why is it what's the rate?
This was your spec, right? This is the spec given by the system engineers. This is what's going to be compliant with EMI on the 48 volt bus.
Is there some vendor for the?
That's where you would define it from. This is defined as 0.1 because it's an example. No specific reason for that. Okay, so the TI tool spits out a design that biases towards using its own parts whenever possible. But what it gave me is a boost converter. It has a 22 microhenry inductor with about 2 milliohms of series resistance. It has two 10 milliohm FETs connected directly in parallel, gate drain and source all in parallel, give me an equivalent 5 milliohm FET. Has a output capacitance of 22 microfarads. And selected a switching frequency of 202 kilohertz. And has an efficiency prediction of 93%. Okay, I'm going to take that. Everything over here has to do with controller modulation. So they gave it a control IC, designed a compensator around that, set it up for under voltage lockout and some other protections. I'm not going to worry so much about that at the moment. I'm just going to look at steady state operation of the boost. Okay. So if I take this design, I want to play around with it a little bit. So I implemented that same thing in LTSpice, just an open loop, same inductor, two 10 milliohm FETs in parallel, diode capacitance, and a 48 ohm resistance. And I simulated it, and indeed, actually, in LTSpice, slightly better than the prediction. Predicted 93, I'm getting 93.9%. Okay. So that's the result, but before I look at waveforms, what do I expect to see out of this? Well, this is a boost converter. You're all very familiar with this, MEC481 or some comparable course. It's going to have waveforms look like over here on the right. I'm looking at the drain to source current of the MOSFET, and that's going to be the sum of these two things. So I'll just label them as IDS over 2, IDS over 2. They're exactly identical, share the current evenly. So that current ramps up when the switches are on according to V over L, the inductor. When the switch is shut off, my diode current here, ID, takes the full inductor current until the end of the period when I turn the FETs back on. The inductor current itself is the sum of the two of those. And then this last one is the voltage on the inductor. Okay, and I can use my 481 type analysis, say, well, I'm going to apply waveform averaging on the inductor current and the capacitor voltage. It's going to tell me the conversion ratio is 1 over D prime for this boost converter. The input current is going to be, I've got 48 watts and 12 volts in. So the input current is going to be 4 amps. I can calculate the ripple of this inductor current. Say IL, my input current is P over VG. It's 4 amps for this case. This is 12 volts. This is 48 watts, 1 amp at 48 volts. My delta IL, calculate as VG over L times DTS, and that is, what are my numbers? Two amps, where this is two delta IL, so is 4 amps, because I didn't put that on the right side. My actual delta IL is 2 amps. This calculation, this difference between this value and this value, which is twice my labeled delta IL, being the difference between the average and the peak. Okay. So these are just some general waveforms. On the next slide, I'm going to look at what happens when I plug these things into the LTSPICE simulation and run it. I get waveforms that look like this. And what I'm showing here is the diode current, ID, IDS, because of these two parallel devices, some of the current through each of them, drain currents on M1 and M2. And then output voltage, switch node voltage, inductor current, as expected. And these bottom two things are the input and output power. So use this SD efficiency. V out is equal to V times I out through the resistor. V in is equal to VG times IL. Okay. And then you've got a nice 48 watts at the output. I see the inductor current ripple here with about 48 watts at the input, a little more because of the 6% losses. Okay, look at the inductor current. It's about 4 amps, about 2 amps peak to peak ripple. And my waveforms through my switches look pretty similar to what I expected. Kind of trapezoidal waveform through the MOSFET current, and then the opposite slope trapezoid through the diode. But there's this difference here, right? My MOSFET current has this big spike and then really tracks what I expect. My diode current turns on, turn off, it has this big spike. That wasn't in my ideal analysis. There's some unknown spike here. I'm going to zoom in, see what's going on. So as I zoom in on this spike, I get these waveforms. Again, my MOSFET drain to source current, my diode current, and here I have switch node voltage, and then the VGS drive voltage of the MOSFET. Okay. VGS, and then these two things are the instantaneous power on my diode and my MOSFET. So this is P diode, which is the voltage in the diode times the current in the diode. This is PDS, VDS, IDS. So this looks bad. I've got a 4 amps in, 1 amp out converter, and I'm seeing my currents instantaneously go up to about 400 amps. What the heck? So what's happening here?
Reverse recovery.
See that? This is my diode current. Diode. So it's very negative, which would be current flowing in reverse through the diode direction. That's not allowed in steady state. So our initial candidate here is reverse recovery. see if that explains it. What kind of happens during the switching transition? Well, here's the time where I begin. This is when the gate to source voltage initially goes high. VGS goes from 0 to 10 volts, what I actually apply for my gate driver. Then there's some delay where nothing happens. Sometimes called TD on, or turn on delay, where that voltage is being applied external to the device, kind of propagating and charging the internal capacitances, bringing the internal true oxide voltage up enough to get the device to turn on. Okay. At this time, because of the scale, I can't really see the exact point, but the MOSFET begins turning on and the diode current, which started at 4 amps, begins decreasing and hits 0 amps. So 0 amps, diode no longer has any current through it, but we see this current just continue to drop all the way down to some minus 400 amps going backwards through the diode. Okay. And during this time, here you see a little bit of voltage change at the switch node. Really, the diode is still on, still clamping the switch node voltage to the output. But when I put 500 amps through it, there's a little bit of IR drop through that diode. Okay. And that, just as an aside here, the resistance of this diode part is 40 milliohms. And 400 amps times RD, 40 milliohms, is about 15 volts, which is about what I get here. So during this time, even though the voltage is dropping, that diode's actually still on, still conducting. There's just some IR drop from this massive current. Okay. So it's really not until this time here, this peak negative current, that the diode actually turns off. Diode becomes reverse biased. Here, diode shuts off. Now the switch node voltage can drop. The MOSFET can come down into a low loss region. The current through the diode quickly snaps back up to 0. The MOSFET current drops down to steady state 4 amps. Okay, in my 48 watt converter, I don't typically like to see over 10 kilowatts of instantaneous power loss, right? Keep in mind, these are instantaneous, and this is really zoomed in on the switching transition. It's not like I have a true 10 kilowatts of average loss. Instead, what I have is whatever energy is dissipated under this power curve happening once per period. I calculated those energies here, 5.8 microjoules in the MOSFET, 1.3 microjoules in the diode. If I sum those up, I'll call it E on, which would be the total energy that I dissipated during this turn-on transition of the MOSFET. And that's going to be about 7 microjoules if I sum these two things up. Not caring where I lost it, just knowing that I lost 5.8 plus 1.3 microjoules. And that's going to contribute to an average power loss, which is this energy times the switching frequency. I lose that energy once every period. So my P on is E on times FS, and that's about 1.5 watts at 202 kilohertz. 1.5 watts out of my 48 watt output is about 3% of my power. It means I've degraded my efficiency by about 3% because of this loss mechanism, this reverse recovery. Say, in that room, 1.5 over 48, about 3%. My efficiency is going to drop 3% because of this reverse recovery, and that's included in this number. I just ran the simulation, saw what the efficiency is. So it's 94%. I have 6% of my power goes to loss, but half of that is just reverse recovery. I could get rid of all this loss, conceivably cut my losses in half, get myself up to 97% efficiency. So how can I do that? Well, let's look at what causes this loss. Just as a review, I expect that people have seen this before. Diode reverse recovery, where does it come from? And how does it affect circuit operation? So diode reverse recovery is the result of using a minority carrier device. The silicon PN power diode is a minority carrier device. It means that when it's conducting, using electrons in the P-type material to support the current, holes in the N-type material to support the current. Okay. If I, for example, look at a cross-section of this diode, P-type semiconductor, N-type semiconductor, PP wouldn't work. As I push current through this thing, what's going to happen is holes from the P-type region are going to be swept into the N-type region to support the current. Electrons from the N-type region move into the P-type region. If I go greater current, I have more and more conductors jumping across. They're used to support the external current, I diode. Problem with that is as I go to high currents, I get a bunch of electrons built up in my P-type material, a bunch of holes built up in my N-type material. That makes this diode conductive, but if I want to shut it off, I got to get all that charge out of there. Okay. The higher current, the more charge injection. One of the great things about minority carrier devices, I go higher and higher current, I get more and more carriers to support that current, and I don't get a strong increase in losses. Okay. Do that comparison in a moment. So as I look at this MOSFET turn-on transition, so I've got just a simple subsection of my boost converter here. I turn on the MOSFET. Initially, the diode is conducting, got the current ID, and then VD I've labeled in this way, which is kind of inconsistent with my normal power matching notation, but just that everything would be positive here. Okay. So as I try to turn on this MOSFET, ideally the diode was conducting. As I turn on the MOSFET, it shuts off and the MOSFET takes the current. But thinking about what's actually going on with the carriers in this device, here I turn on the MOSFET. Prior to that, the diode is conducting a current, IF. The MOSFET begins to turn on. It'll begin taking away this current, IL. Here, IF is equal to IL prior to the MOSFET turn on. MOSFET will begin taking some of that current away. Some of the diode and MOSFET current will be this inductor current, but more and more of it's going to start going over to the MOSFET. That's this transition here. Okay. Until it reaches a current of 0 amps through the diode, I am still injecting minority carriers. The rate at which I do so is decreasing and more are recombining. As long as there's a positive current going through the diode, I'm still injecting minority carriers. I'm still supporting this stored charge. It's not until my diode current hits zero that I'll stop injecting minority carriers. However, I still have the minority stored charge that's built up in each region. And to get the diode to shut off, I have to pull all of that out. That's this next interval, TA, where I remove minority carriers. And in order to do that, the current has to continue along the same DIDT going negative to get all of those charges out. At some point after I've removed the QA, which was my total minority stored charge, the diode can actually shut off. This is the time when the diode actually becomes reverse biased. The voltage on it can begin rising. It's no longer locked in forward bias, more or less a short. I still have a little bit of charge that needs to go into the diode. That charge supports expansion of the depletion region. It's no longer minority charge, it's actually majority charge. So this here is depletion region charge. Okay, this ramp right here, DIDT, really depends on the impedance through your power loop. Any inductance in there will limit the rate at which I can ramp down the current. That's different for every design. Okay. So, if you were in 481 or 482, we simplified these waveforms a little bit to make calculations easier. For reverse recovery type loss, we assumed diode voltage Just to warn you guys that it's not that rare of a thing for me to do. That'll happen again. I'm sorry about that. So we simplified the calculation by assuming, call it VD star, that the voltage on the diode looks like this, just jumps immediately at this point, or equivalently assuming that this QA is real small, QB is real big. That allows us to do is make a simple calculation of what the total loss is here. Then the total loss looks like PRR is equal to the energy lost in this process times the switching frequency, like FS times output voltage IL TRR plus QRRV. Excuse me, I drew this wrong. This should be here. Assume it rises at the end. At the beginning. Okay. Then the total loss is calculated as two components, one from all this charge and one from the current itself and where it's going. Where does this loss show up? What element is going to get hot because of this? The MOSFET. And as I got ready to ask you that quiz question, that's how I realized I had drawn this wrong. The diode has low voltage during this. It's still more or less zero, still more or less a short. And because of that, this is still a short. It means the full output voltage, V, is being applied across the MOSFET. As the current transitions from the diode to the MOSFET after this point, the MOSFET is conducting the full inductor current with the full output of voltage across it. And then as I go past this point, not just the full inductor current, but the full inductor current plus the current for all of this charge sharing flows in a loop like this. Okay. So we've got this loss mechanism. The majority of that is going to show up in the MOSFET in our LTSPICE simulation. We see that if I don't apply these simplified approximations of the diode voltage, there is a little bit of loss, but the majority is in the MOSFET. The one that's hit the hardest, yeah.
Would there be a disadvantage
to
using the Schottky diode in this application?
The only disadvantage I can think of is that you have to wait a couple slides before you put a Schottky diode in. Potentially there are, but we make a couple comments and then we'll talk about using the Schottky diode. Okay. So this reverse recovery charge just practically depends on your current and voltage, your circuit operation, switching frequency, but also these parameters, TRR and QRR. TRR is the total time of this reverse recovery process. And QRR, then label QRR is QA plus QB. I split them into two different charges here. Okay. So when I look at a data sheet for a given diode, I can find, if it's a good diode, some of these parameters, but they are highly nonlinear. I look at QRR, it changes with current, it changes with temperature, changes with the DISDT rate, which is a function of my exact power loop design. So same thing with TRR, QRR, and TRR, both functions of things like the forward current, the DISDT rate, the temperature, other things. This depends heavily on how the actual, the trends here depend heavily on how the actual diode was designed. So there's not really a great and accurate simplified model for how these things vary with operating points. It tends to be somewhat difficult to model these reverse recovery losses. So instead, we find a way to get rid of them. Look at just emphasizing this point of the minority versus majority carrier device. Here I'm not necessarily looking at diodes, but I'm looking at a MOSFET, vertical power MOSFET on the left versus an IGBT and a vertical power device on the right. MOSFET is a majority carrier device. IGBT is a minority carrier. So these structures look dominantly similar. The only difference is this drain or collector layer down here is N-type in a MOSFET, P-type in an IGBT, and the actual design of these devices would be significantly different because of that. They are going to use different mechanisms to conduct current when in the on state. So a MOSFET conducts current through this N minus region, sometimes called my drift region. I'm going to conduct current from drain to source. I go through a channel here. When I turn gate voltage high, I can pull charges in to this P-type region from surrounding N-type regions to create a conductive channel. And then I have a conductive pathway all the way through this thing. This drift region is the majority of the conduction channel in high voltage devices. It's going to be a majority of the resistance, and it's going to be where I block voltage when it turns off. And in this drift region in a MOSFET, the lightly doped N minus region, and my carriers are whatever carriers I doped into that region. So I put some electrons here with some doping density, and I'm limited to the number of carriers that I doped into it when I created this. How heavily doped is my N minus region? My IGBT, still, since it's an insulated gate device, I'll create a channel, I'll have this current pathway, but as I conduct through this N minus region, what I'll get is minority carrier injection, which is going to bring holes into my N minus region from my more moderately doped P-type region. Those holes are what supports my current, and it means that my conduction resistance is not dominated by how heavily I dope this region. I dope it very lightly because I want it to block a lot of voltage, and then inject a bunch of charge into it when I want it to conduct. Okay. That effect is known as conductivity modulation. In minority carrier devices, I can inject minority carriers in order to increase the conductivity, decrease resistivity. So that's a great thing. I get conductivity modulation. Low resistance at high currents. The bad thing is, just like the PN diode that we looked at, to turn this thing off, I got to get all those minority charges out. minus removing minority charges. It shut off. For the MOSFET, my characteristics are really the opposite. I'm going to have no minority stored charge and relatively little majority stored charge. Turning this thing off, really I could turn it off almost instantaneously. Look at later, there are charges that I have to inject in order to increase the voltage on it just due to parasitic capacitances, but nothing that I have to remove to shut it off, virtually none. So good thing, very low stored charge. Benefit I pay for that is I don't have conductivity modulation. That means the resistance of this device is going to be dictated by my doping, and how heavily I can dope this is really kind of a multifaceted optimization in terms of what voltage do I want to block. I want to block a lot of voltage. I need the strip region to be either real long or very lightly doped. Both of those make my resistance higher. I want to block a lot of voltage. I have to dope lightly, which means my resistance is high, and I can't dope any heavier because of that voltage limit. I can't drop that resistance. Okay. Resistance, let's call it R on, limited by doping. How many majority carriers I doped into the material. Okay. So just to show that effect in an IGBT analogous to the reverse recovery, what's known as current tailing in an IGBT, when it tries to turn off, voltage rises, but the current tails out. Current decreases very slowly because it still has these minority stored charges that have to be removed before it can shut off. So kind of all of this here is additional loss due to it being a minority carrier device. Okay, but there is a solution. If we want to get these switching losses down, if we're really being penalized by the minority stored charge, we use a majority carrier device. For an IGBT, that's a MOSFET. For a diode, it's a Schottky diode. Schottky diode is not a PN junction. It's an N-to-metal junction, which has no minority stored charge. Similar to the IGBT versus MOSFET case, it's going to mean I have no conductivity modulation. So at high voltage, Schottkys traditionally made out of silicon are terrible. They're very high resistance because they are huge, long, lightly doped N-type regions with no conductivity modulation of resistances in the ohms. You may be aware new wide bandgap materials, including silicon carbide, have created better high voltage Schottky diodes, but they still have the same fundamental limit. PN diode, minority carrier device versus majority carrier device. If I go to high voltage, my doping density has to be low. I'm going to get higher resistance. Okay. At 48 volts, I can get a relatively decent silicon Schottky diode. If I plug that in my simulation, I go from 94% to almost 96% with the silicon Schottky, which is about a 2% increase in efficiency. But as you recall, when I came back here and calculated, I said this loss was decreasing my efficiency by 3%. So I should have gained back 3% if I got rid of all. So, no secret, this is a Schottky diode. It indeed does not have any reverse recovery charge, but I'm missing a percent. And I think we're out of time, so we'll pick up on Monday with how to get that percent back. Thank you.